welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 149. This week, we talk with Scott Hunter about the latest .NET announcements from Build. We even cover XAML and some amazing Azure tooling. This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week we have Scott Hunter, Director of Program Management for the .NET platform. How's it going, Scott?
Going very good.
So this is so we are recording before Build, but we're going to be talking about some things that will likely get announced at Build, and I don't know what order we're releasing these episodes in, but you know, it is what it is. So this is the way pre-recording works.
I hope it's not likely to be announced at Build, because at this point it's too late.
past the point of no return. Yeah, if you hear any kind of like beeping in the episode, that was stuff that we just made up. Carl, what do we have for the comment of the week?
The comment of the week gets a developer small business license for Espose.total for .NET, which includes all of the Espose.NET products in one package. And this week, we select somebody who didn't directly try to reach out to us to comment, but they actually gave us a pull request for our website. So we have that out on GitHub, github.com/ytechie/msdevshow. And he actually fixed our mobile view. So if you have a phone, he made that look good. It was kind of jacked up for a long time. And we just kind of...
We were way too lazy to fix it.
Way too lazy. So, we don't have anything else to give you, but we'll make sure you get a license for this. So he made the header and the banner look spot on.
Yeah.
Actually, how it should have been.
Yeah.
And if you want to get mentioned on the show, you can send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com. Comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher. We really like those 5-star iTunes reviews.
Yeah. So you're missing the funniest part of this whole story, Carl. So Carl reaches out to me and he's like, "Hey, can you take a look at this pull request?" And I said, "Hey, I'm already on it." And he's like, "You know, my dev environment on my machine for the podcast is not quite set up correctly." And it was funny because I didn't even really realize what he meant by that. And you know, so I was taking the easy approach. So I took the pull request, I just hit merge, and then I watched our build process, which takes, I don't know, like 5 minutes or something. And then I tested it in production. I mean, why would I test it any other way, Carl? And then I, you know, Carl's like, "Oh, you know, good, you have all this stuff set up." He's like, "Nope, I just test in production." So, you know,
is that how Microsoft normally does it, Jason?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess it probably depends on the product. No, they are much, much better than I am. We, you know, I don't know. Everything other than us speaking is really overhead for the show. So we try to do everything as, half-assed and easy as possible. But it worked. He actually wrote good code. So, it's now in production. It's all good. Let's see. What do we got for the news, Carl? We got how .NET Standard relates to .NET platforms. And actually, this will be good for Scott to comment on as well.
Yeah, so we have this little GitHub gist that kind of explains in code how .NET Standard and .NET Core and .NET Full kind of all interact with each other in a way using interfaces and classes and if you look at this, it just makes sense. You look at it and you see that in .NET Standard 1, there was primitives, reflection, task, collections, and link. And in .NET Standard 1.1 is everything there and just adds more features. And you see how they interact. So if you need to know, like, if, you know, at a high level, is this going to work? You can kind of just look at this. And it's actually pretty easy to reason about. And it makes you understand, like, okay, if I have to create, you know, a .NET standard library to support multiple things, this is a way to help kind of figure out, will it work?
Yeah. I love this because it shows like the inheritance model, because, you know, we always think in code, and this shows how versions essentially inherit from other versions. So Scott, I assume that you've seen this from David Fowler.
I have seen this. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. This was great. I assume this thing is up to date. I don't know if he's updated it since the initial release.
It was updated yesterday.
Oh, okay, cool. So this, yeah.
Yeah, and then kind of related to this, too, there's another really awesome website out there called apisof.net. And if you can do a search on there, it'll find any .NET library. So if you want to, like, look up cryptography or Link or, you know, a bunch of other things, you can go there and it'll tell you on that specific one where it's all supported.
Okay. They got apisof.net?
Yes.
Okay. They have a bogus HTTP certificate.
Yeah, it's easier if you don't look at it in Chrome.
Okay. I proceeded at my own peril. This is pretty cool, though. Oh, wow. Look at that. Okay. That's pretty cool. Good find, Carl. Okay. So, yeah, let's talk to Scott since we got him here. We can talk directly to the expert here. So, you know, Scott, I know that the Visual Studio 2017 was just released just a few weeks ago. It's an awesome release. I love the new installer. We actually talked to Amanda Silver about all the great features in there. Super exciting. So I guess we'll put this question to you specifically around .NET Core. You know, what's new in the .NET Core tooling in VS 2017?
So VS 2017 is actually the first time we shipped RTM'd .NET Core tooling.
Okay.
So just for people's history, we actually shipped .NET Core 1.0 back in June of 2016. And then we had a variety of tooling preview releases in that time frame. I think we had one in June, we had another one in November, and then we had the RTM of 2017 that happened in March. The big change that happened in that time frame between June and March was we moved away from the Project JSON format back to the CSproj format. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty significant change, and the main thing we tell customers when they ask why did you do that is when we built Project JSON, when we started the .NET Core project, it was really about building web applications, and they were kind of its own unique universe. Mm-hmm. And then it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point that now we want to share code with .NET Framework, we want to share code with Xamarin, and the reality of trying to make Project JSON be able to communicate back and forth with all the different CSproj based tooling that was out there just proved too big. And so we took a different approach, was take the best of Project JSON and move it back into .CSproj. So if you try that tooling, there's a couple cool things in that tooling that are built into VS. For the first time ever, you can actually right click on a project and open your CSproj file live in Visual Studio. Before, you would have to actually open it as a separate XML file and unload your project and reload your project to make it make the changes take place. But at the same time, I would actually challenge before in the old CSproj, there really wasn't a reason to open that file anyways. It was full of too much complicated goop. A console app has 158 lines of CSproj.
Yeah, the only thing I ever changed in there was path references to project files generally.
Yep. I think we've all done that before, and then you might have also, you know, if you're working on project and source control, you are going to see that file quite often, because as you actually add files to your project, you're going to have to merge that change into CSproj, because before every single file in your app was actually listed in that file. So a couple of the big changes that we made in that March release is first off, that file is very, very simple now. You basically reference the .NET framework that you're referencing, and you put your package references in. So this is new as well. Your package references are there, but I think the big things I would highlight is we added what we call globbing support, and globbing support means that we don't list every single file in your project in that CSproj anymore. We wildcard in, everything star.cs.
Right.
And so that's pretty cool. It means if you want to add a file to your project, just drop it in the folder, and it shows up in the Solution Explorer, delete it from the folder. It deletes from the Solution Explorer. It never touches your CSproj file. That's not required. And so that's a huge thing. That's a big piece that we moved from the Project JSON world into that. We also took your package references, which used to be in a separate file, and we moved those into the CSproj as well. And so those are there. And that was because people that were using the Project JSON really enjoyed being able to hand edit the packages their application used. And so we move those directly into the CSproj as well. And so you're going to, for the most part, it's going to be your output type, your target framework, and your package references. So it's a very simplified format. You can live edit it in Visual Studio, and you're good to go. And so that was the first wave of you know, getting the core tooling into VS.
So I actually don't see the glob in there. So by default, does it just include everything?
It globs.cs by default, yes.
Okay, and then if I exclude a file, then it must add an exception to the project?
It will add an exception to the project.
Oh, wow. Yeah, this is like, it's my, so mine on a brand new .NET Core console application is 12 lines, two of which are actually just blank. And like everything in here is 100% understandable. So that's huge.
And it actually gets even, it'll get even better in the 2.0 bits that we're going to ship at build.
Okay.
So is this support for the new CS proj and all the project types, or is it just really .NET Core first and we'll bring the rest around later?
It's .NET Core first and we'll bring the rest around later. And I'll kind of explain why we did it that way. So when we built a new project system, it's a new project system. And so we knew that, you know, .NET Core, there's bound to be bugs in having a brand new project system in the product. And we didn't want to go and shove this new project system into, you know, your WinForm apps, your WPF apps, your console apps, your class library apps. We didn't want to shove that into everything, knowing that there could be a, you know, bugs there that, you know, most of the folks that have existing projects have been using those projects for years and years and years and years. And I don't want to risk, you know, any quality issues there. And so I'd rather actually work any of the bugs out with the .NET Core folks, which are typically new folks, mm-hmm. With new projects, and not, you know, have any chance of messing up legacy projects that customers have. So that's typically a very bad experience when you upgrade to a new version of Visual Studio and you know, you find some issues with projects that you've been running for years and years and years. And so the idea is we'll try it first with the .NET Core folks, and then in the future we'll move that support across the all the existing legacy projects.
I think that's a good approach. Now, you mentioned in .NET Core 2.0 that there's even more project file changes. So can you tell me about those?
It's not really project file changes. It's going to be package changes.
Oh, okay.
So, and let me, I'll kind of run through some of the things that are the main things that we're changing in 2.0. So .NET Core 2.0 is not a, it is a major update. It's also not a major change. It's just the experience changed enough that we thought it warranted a new version. And so I'll kind of run through the highlights of what's in .NET Core 2.0 and why we gave it a new name. Number one is it supports .NET Standard 2. That's probably the primary thing is, you know, we started the call off talking about .NET Standard. And .NET, just to do a recap for folks that might not know what .NET Standard is, .NET Standard was meant to be that when we looked at the .NET platform, you know, over the years, we've had a variety of different .NETs. We've had .NET Framework, we've had UWP, we've had Silverlight, we had Xamarin. There's a lot of these different .NETs, and all of them have different APIs. And so as we started working on the .NET Core bits, and we were asking ourselves, people really want to be able to share code they've written across all these projects. A big frustration today is you might have some WinForms code, and you want to go paste that into a UWP application, and you can't because some of those APIs don't exist. Or you might start building an ASP.NET Core application and decide you want to go grab some code from one of your old system web-based ASP.NET applications, and you paste the code in and it doesn't work. And so that is something we really, really care about, is being able to share code across all the .NETs. And historically, the way you've done this is with portable class libraries. And the idea behind a portable class library is you create this class library, and then you bring up a dialog box and you tell it, I want to support these frameworks. And as you click more and more frameworks, the API surface shrinks each time you click one, because it's the intersection of all those frameworks. Mm-hmm. And so .NET Standard takes the opposite approach, which is what we did is we took all the APIs that were consistent across Xamarin projects and .NET Framework projects, and we said, that is the surface area of .NET Standard and .NET Standard 2. And what we'll do is we're basically going to say that we as the .NET team say that if you want to be a .NET standard compliant framework, and right now there's three frameworks that I think of off the top of my head, which would be .NET Framework, .NET Core, and Xamarin. If you want to be a .NET standard compliant framework, here is a contract of all the APIs that you must implement. And so in our case, as the bits we're giving away at build, we have support across those three platforms. That means that if you write code using the APIs in .NET Standard 2, it is completely portable across all of those different .NETs. Mm-hmm. We shipped the first version of .NET Standard back with .NET Core 1.0. In that time, one of the challenges we had was we didn't have all the APIs that the customer might want. It was a pretty small subset of the API surface area. In .NET Standard 2, we have brought back 20,000 APIs into
just a couple.
.NET Standard. Yeah. And even crazier, we went and analyzed the NuGet library. If you go to NuGet.org, we analyzed all the packages in NuGet.org, mm-hmm. and the new numbers are, with .NET Standard 2, over 70% of all the packages that have ever been written will now work on anything that's .NET Standard 2 compliant. And wow. .NET Core 2 is .NET Standard compliant, which means we went from maybe supporting 20%. Of all the packages to 70% in this release. And so it's a mega pile of new APIs that are available to the customer.
And that's without library authors having to change anything too. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, .NET Standard 2 does not require anybody to change any code. So
they just recompile, right?
You just reference and compile. Okay. So basically, one of the demos I'm doing at Build is I took a library that was written in 2004, and I just referenced it into a .NET Core project, and it just worked. I also went and found an old WinForm application that I had that used data sets and data tables, and I grabbed that code, and I loaded Northwind up into that thing and displayed some rows from it, and I copied that code and pasted it into an ASP.NET Core application, and it just ran.
That's really cool.
And so, you know.
So this is when people are really going to start adopting this. So
let's your first question though was what changed in the project JSON in the CS project file?
Yeah.
And I want to finish that before you.
Sure, go ahead.
And so in the 1.0 time frame, we also shipped .NET as a .NET Core as a series of packages. And the idea when we first were working on the project, the idea was, hey, we don't want to ship .NET as this big monolithic thing anymore. We want to ship it as a bunch of packages, and that'll give us more agility because we can update those packages without having to update the entire framework. And that idea proved not to be valid. The reality is, if you change one of those low-level packages at the bottom, it likely is going to ripple across the entire world, and it made customers' projects more complicated as well, because it meant they had to reference a whole bunch of packages. So I'm looking at a ASP.NET Core 1.0 project right here on my computer, and I've got 22 lines to build a very basic ASP.NET Core application. I've got 22 lines of CS Prod, and of that, six of those lines are referencing. I'll just read some of these: mm-hmm. Microsoft.ASP.NET Core, Microsoft.ASP.NET Core.MVC, Microsoft.ASP.NET Core.static files, Microsoft.extensions.logging.debug. First off, if I just want to go build an ASP.NET Core application, I don't want the developer to have to know all those things.
Yeah.
And so what we did is in the 2.0 wave, we also shipped .NET Core as a single entity. And so I'm now looking at a ASP.NET Core 2.0 CS Proj file. It's 11 lines, and it references one package. The package is Microsoft.ASP.NET Core.all.
Well, that's pretty cool.
So the idea is, you know, we still want to keep working to simplify using .NET. Mm-hmm. And so in my CS project I'm looking here, it references .NET Core App 2.0, and it references, so that's referencing, you know, the full framework, and then it references ASP.NET with Microsoft.ASP.NET Core.all. Mm-hmm. And so anybody should be able to write those two lines of CS Proj without having to go look at some chart or go to a website to figure out, you know, which type is in which package. And, you know, there's a continuing wave of us trying to simplify the usage of .NET. I want it to be as simple as using Node or Python or Go or anything else.
Yeah, I think there's two different paths, right? And I've always thought of it this way, because when, you know, there's this .NET world, and I think MVC was kind of the culmination of this, where you'd you'd go in and say, I want to create a new MVC project, and it would just go like, bleh, and you'd have, I don't know, like 50 files, and you'd have all these references and everything. And then I go into Node.js, and it's, you literally just like copy and paste like a few lines from the internet. You just paste it into a text file, and then you run it. And you know, those are like two completely different approaches. And it sounds like you can sort of pick either one. I mean, if you want to build from the bottom up and be very specific and have like this tiny little optimized program, you can do that by referencing only what you need. Or it sounds like you can take some shortcuts as well. And it's easy to migrate things because you can sort of reference all and get up and running a lot quicker, no matter which direction you come in at.
Well, we ship .NET Core 2.0 is a single thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's really no different if you reference all or you reference a few of the little things. And so
I got you.
I think you're going to reference a few of the little things, and I mean, you're going to reference the one line and just call it good. You don't have to.
Yeah.
So it's and honestly, it is exactly what you were describing. It is wanting to have that exact experience where, hey, you don't have to know 50 lines of stuff to get going. Just I want to use .NET Core. Boom, done. That really is where we want to. You get the framework too. When it does come to size, the only time you would care about referencing packages directly is if you're building what we call a standalone application, and that is a self-contained app where you actually ship the framework as part of your application. At that point, you might actually want to have an optimized package graph that only contains the packages your app uses. But I'm not going to make you write that. I'm going to let the tooling do that for you. So I'll give you, it won't be a build, but sometime post-build, we'll give you a feature in VS and command line as well that says, hey, when I build a standalone application, only put in the packages that I actually use. And we'll do the hard work for you versus you having to go try to figure out by hand in a text file what are the minimum requirements for your project. So my goal is to make this stuff easy. And you shouldn't have to be trying to do that yourself.
No, that's great. I think that was one of the reasons why Node became so popular was that, and the funny thing about it is, I think you always end up in the same place. You know, your application has a certain level of complexity. There's a certain number of things you need, but it's kind of interesting that build up versus like tear down approach. And it makes Node look easier when in fact, you know, it's just that you're going one step at a time. And now with .NET Core, you know, you can kind of take that same approach where it's like, all I want to do is I just want to respond to this request with like this simple string. And then, and then after a while you're like, well, you know what? I need routing and I need to add, you can sort of layer and learn those things as you go along. And I think that's actually pretty huge, letting somebody sort of add code as they learn instead of starting with a big ball of code and figuring it out.
Yeah, we actually, one of the terms we used internally when we were going through this wave of work was, we called it removing the magic. So it used to be that if you were building one of those MVC applications before, there was a bunch of magic. How did routing get booted up? How did the actual web app even start? You know, if you look at a .NET Core 2 application or an ASP.NET Core 2 application, there is actually a program.cs, and there is a main inside of it. And that is the entry point to your app, just like you would expect. In one of those older MVC applications, there's some magic that happened and suddenly your app was running and you don't know how or why that happened. So, we let you actually either build up from scratch, one component at a time, or you can take a full framework. And that is that was a huge design choice that we made with the .NET Core way.
Yeah. So it feels like the pendulum started at like configuration and then we went to convention. Are we coming back to configuration then basically? Is that how you see it?
We are actually... Funny you mentioned that. In the ASP.NET Core 2 wave, we are going to come back to a little bit of configuration.
Okay.
And some of that's good. What we did, you know, if you kind of follow the frameworks over time, even back into the MVC 4 and 5 timeframe, we got very codey where, you know, if you wanted to go enable OAuth with like Google or you would very explicitly write C# code to do that. And that was by design. We wanted it not to feel like it was magic. We wanted you to write the code because you wrote the code. You could see exactly, oh, this is the secret. You know, this is the endpoint. It was very, very clear. We're going to make a small swing a little bit backwards. where you can now have a choice. You can either write the thing in code, line by line by line, or we will have the ability to do some of those things via configuration. Mm-hmm. The benefit of configuration for us, code is great because it's very clear and very explicit, but it also makes it very difficult for us to tool the product. You know, imagine me being able to say, I just want to let you right click on your project and add support for Google OAuth or Microsoft OAuth. For me to do that, because it's code, we have to somehow guess or find in your application where that code is. Where do we put it in? If I support configuration, I can just drop a config file and the system will pick that up. And so in the ASP.NET Core 2.0 wave, we're going to bring a little bit of that configuration over code back. But once again, it's still, you can always do it by code. And also by code, you can say, look at config. And if you put the code in saying look for config, then you can write the config file, and that'll make our tooling a lot better. Along those lines, I'd love to talk about there's a huge topic that it's probably my favorite thing that we're showing at Build, mm-hmm. and this is around diagnostics and cloud. So one of the things when we started the ASP.NET Core wave. That we were thinking about was we wanted to make running your app in the cloud awesome. And let me explain what I mean by that. Today, if you want your app to run in the cloud, where do your log files go? Where do you log in the right places? So,
the wrong place by default, right?
Yes, they do. if you're running like an Azure app service, you have to know to go grab a NuGet package and stick the NuGet package in to make that work. That's kind of complicated. Mm-hmm. Another one is if you want more details on your application, you need some kind of you know, framework that gives you more insight into your application. And the one that Microsoft builds internally is App Insights. But App Insights kind of puts a bad taste in my mouth when I use it today because I go and I click to add App Insights to my project, and it adds a bunch of NuGet packages to my web app. It goes and adds code to my startup.cs. It adds code to my views. It's like I feel dirty after I turned it on because it like went and put crud all over the place.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. If I turn it on by default, then customers complain. They're like, why did you put this junk in my project? I just want my clean project.
Yeah.
If you don't turn it on, then nobody knows it exists.
Yeah.
When we shipped VS 2017 in March, we actually turned App Insights on by default for all ASP.NET projects. And we turned it on because of a feature that most people aren't even aware of, which is App Insights actually has a local console that you can actually run when you're developing locally. You don't actually have to publish to Azure or use any Azure at all. And most people aren't even aware that that exists.
I wasn't even aware of it, honestly.
See? So we turned it on in ASP.NET Core by default in March because we thought that feature that was built into VS was awesome. But we immediately got complaints. Hey, what is this App Insights line in my program.cs?
And it's probably Microsoft is spying on me.
Yes. So in this 2.0 wave, there's another change coming, which is we now allow things like Visual Studio, which is the environment you're developing in, it can now inject App Insights when you debug. So you don't have to go and add App Insights to your project. You don't have to go modify any of the files in the project. If you wanted to debug and open the App Insights window in Visual Studio, well, Visual Studio can just go and load App Insights into your project for you on the fly. That's kind of cool. Now, where this gets insane is when you start running your ASP.NET Core application in Azure. Because what I really want is I want to give Azure some of that same capability. So in this wave, and we demoed this at Build, I take my ASP.NET Core application and I just publish it to Azure App Service. Mm-hmm. I've added no logging DLLs. I've added no App Insights. And I start hearing from my customers that my app's crashing. What can I do? So I go to the portal, and there'll be a new banner that will show up in the portal saying enable App Insights. And you click the banner. And when you do that, we will actually enable App Insights dynamically on the fly in the cloud for you.
Wow.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
Yes. So here's the thinking here. when your app starts crashing, do you really want to go, oh, I need to go find App Insights or New Relic or whatever and add that and republish my application? No. When you find when you hear your app's crashing, you just want to go check it out and find out what's going on. So now you just go to the portal and you can turn it on or off right from the portal. But it gets better. Not only do we enable App Insights via that mechanism, we also activate a little part of Azure that's been there for a while that most people aren't even aware of. We activate something called Service Profiler. And what Service Profiler is it uses some of the App Insights APIs to work. But what it does is it installs a very lightweight profiler into your application when it's running in Azure. And what that lightweight profiler does is it looks for errors, common errors in your application. So for example, let's say you've got a method foo, and method foo crashes 100 times in the day. Mm-hmm. Well, the profiler is going to go, man, I'm seeing a high crash rate on foo. Maybe I should actually take a snapshot of that. And so the profiler will, on the fly, as the app is running, take a snapshot and store that snapshot in the cloud. Another example of something it might do is it might go, hey, I see you have this page called main in your application. And this main page, normally it takes about half a second. But now I'm starting to see that page take 3 seconds. So I'm seeing a performance anomaly here. So I'm going to take a snapshot of that as well. And now when you go to the portal, you'll actually see a dashboard in the portal that will show you the things that the service profiler is picking up for you. And this is where it gets really, really cool. So you see that your foo method is crashing a lot. So you click foo in the portal. And when you click foo in the portal, it's going to take you to a screen that will actually show you the exception that foo is hitting. It will show you the source code for the method foo. It will show you the call stack, all the variables, everything in the portal. And that's kind of cool. So now I get this really, really detailed view of why foo is crashing. But maybe that's not enough. So there's also a button in the portal called Open in Visual Studio. I click that button, and then we'll basically download the snapshot that we took in the portal to your Visual Studio. Oh, yeah. See, I can hear that. and now I have my cursor at the line that the thing crashed at. I've got the breakpoints. I mean, I've got all the details.
Wow.
Live in Visual Studio.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, actually, I'm not even telling you the coolest part yet.
Just so there's more.
Like the commercial. You need like multiple mics to drop.
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit www.espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial. And if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. Remember, if you're a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for espose.words for .NET. A powerful toolkit to work with Word documents in your applications.
So maybe I look at this and I'm like, man, I still can't figure out why this is crashing. What I really want to do is I want to set a breakpoint, but I don't want to put a breakpoint into a running application, because if I put a breakpoint into my app running in Azure, it's going to stop when customers are using the website.
Yeah.
So we introduced a new concept called snap points. And what a snap point is, it's a point where you basically say, when you hit this line of code, I want you to take a snapshot and send the snapshot to me. So what you'll do is in Visual Studio, you'll go, you know, I looked at the crash that I'm seeing here, and I really, really want to see the code about 15 or 20 lines ahead so I can step through and see how I got to this point. So you go and you create your snap point, just like you create a breakpoint, and there'll be a new banner in the toolbar of Visual Studio that will say deploy snap points. And when you press that button, the Visual Studio will then connect to the app running in the cloud, and it will send the information saying, hey, next time you hit this line of code, make a snapshot. And then while I'm sitting there in VS, I will see in the status window that the snapshot just appears. And once it appears, I can double click it. And now I am actually live debugging an app, but I didn't stop the app in the cloud. The app in the cloud did never stop.
So you're basically, you've like kind of cloned it in a sense.
I've cloned it. Exactly. Okay. I've cloned it.
And you're able to then continue stepping through with the clone.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
I'm able to step through with the clone. And it's just an amazing experience. And the cost of the actual running application, when that line of code was hit that we actually asked for the snap point, the cost that one customer is going to feel is 20 milliseconds.
So that's amazing. Is there any other example of this? Like, does anybody else do that?
No. This is actually.
This seems to be if you're trying to make a case for like using .NET or .NET, you know, whatever, that puts it so far ahead.
Yes, this is what I would call a .NET and an Azure differentiator.
Yeah,
running your .NET code in Azure is just better than running it in Google or running it in AWS or running anything else because of this experience. And I left out one final piece of that experience.
Yeah.
Once again, the snap point feature and even the feature I'm going to mention in right now, these do require you to, your DevOps person has to give you privileges to run this because if I'm actually putting snap points into a running application, I could potentially see customer information. So it's, you have to ask permission to do these things.
That's a good point. But
another cool aspect of this is we've had this feature in VS for a while called CodeLens. And we actually wired this same experience up to CodeLens. And so one thing is, as a DevOps person, I'm in the portal and I'm seeing, you know, all that live data of the crashes and the slow methods and stuff like that. We can also share that same data with Visual Studio. So if I have CodeLens enabled, as I'm moving my mouse around the methods in my application, we will actually show you how many times they were called, what the average runtime was for the, how long they took to execute on average, and how many times they crashed. Mm-hmm. So even as a developer, I'm not in the portal. As I move my mouse through Visual Studio, I am seeing the live data that we're actually collecting in the portal back in VS. So either direction you do this. And as I said, the coolest thing about all this and the point that I think is amazing is notice I never had to republish my application. Mm-hmm. I never had to recompile my application. I'm able to do all of this by default.
Yeah, because I mean, every time I've seen like an issue in production, my goal is always like, okay, I need to reproduce this in my environment. And there's always like, you know, oh, here's how you install this remote debugger or you do it. There was always like a lot of ugliness in there. And this, it feels like this just bypasses all of that completely and just makes it so that I have, you know, the virus is like, you know, turning people into zombies over here, but I'm also able to sit here in my lab and sort of analyze it. And that's completely game changing.
Well, I really like that the idea of getting those live actual stats on how the code actually runs, because in CodeLens before you could see like this line of code took 7 milliseconds to run, but that's in my debugger with, you know, testing scenarios. This is with actual production workloads, production data going through this code and seeing how it is. So if we do need to make an optimization, we can see it visually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would love to come back on in the future and do a show where we actually show all this and demo it live on the talk. Mm-hmm. If we do have video on the calls, right?
Yep. We do. Most of our listeners are audio though. We'd probably be better off. We'd probably be better off just pointing to something on channel 9. I mean, we're on channel 9, but we could do the video, but it would be a little unusual for us. We'd have to, our audio listeners would be like, what's going on?
this is one of the coolest things we've ever done. Yeah. And by the way, I mentioned it in light of .NET Core. Mm-hmm. This will also work for .NET Framework as well.
This will
work for some of this is available at build. All of it will be available later than the summer. But it's a crazy wave. I got one or two more things if we have time that I'd love to announce as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a new, the .NET website, is called dot.net. We've had that for a while. We actually, one of the biggest pieces of feedback I've gotten from customers in recent years is, you know, we used to have this team called Patterns and Practices that built all these really cool books and stuff on how to use our products. Mm-hmm. And, we as a team now are doing that same stuff ourselves. So if you go to dot.net, there's a new link there called architecture across the top of the page. And if you click that, you will see the modern version of patterns and practices for .NET. We've got a couple of these guides. These are actually ebooks you can download and use. One of these is microservices and containers. So we basically walk you through how to build a microservice-based container app using .NET and get that running on either Linux or Windows and get that running in the cloud. We have another architecture guide, another ebook on building web applications, how to build modern web applications. We have one on building mobile applications as well. And what's even cooler is we've built a sample app called eShop. And we've built, that is a full sample that contains everything you would ever imagine. It's got microservices. It's got a web front end. It's got Xamarin iOS, Android applications that go with it. So it basically shows you how to build the entire ecosystem of back-end microservices, web front ends, mobile applications, all on .NET, all with best practices built in. So this is an area that you're going to see us continue as a team to invest in. Mm-hmm. Examples of ones that are coming in the future, we'll have one on modernizing your existing application. So you might have a WinForm or a WPF application. How do you modernize that application to take advantage of microservices and stuff like that? And so this will be a page that I really want customers to check out and look at as we have a bunch of new stuff coming here.
I love it because you have the architect, like I'm looking at the run Windows VMs in multiple regions for high availability. So you have the architecture here and the pieces that you're using. And then I like you have recommendations. And you talk about the configuration of the various services. You even have some of the command line stuff that you would run from the Azure CLI. And then I love this too, availability considerations, because that's the thing. I mean, there's always like nuances in this. So it's like, you know, this is how you'd set this up, but here are the things you need to think about. And then you also have the manageability considerations there as well. So I like that. It's like at least pointers to start thinking about that, because that's, you know, that tends to be what I do. It's like you need to think about these aspects of your application.
We found there was people that actually would choose other technology stacks other than our tech because they had those guides, these types of guides, and we did not.
Yeah.
There's companies just want a book that tells them how to build an architecture, a modern application. And we have great documentation on the low level frameworks, but we didn't have anything saying, you know, from 1,000 feet or 5,000 feet how to build stuff. So that's something really exciting. Another thing that we released at Build that I'm really excited about is we RTM'd Visual Studio for Mac. And you might be going, well, as a .NET Core person, why would I care? Don't you build Xamarin apps with Visual Studio for Mac? Mm-hmm. And the reality is we've taken all of the .NET Core and ASP.NET Core stuff that we have in Visual Studio, and we have put that into Visual Studio for Mac. And so basically the same .NET Core project templates are in VS for Mac.
Okay.
We've taken this a step further. We actually took the exact editors from Visual Studio, the HTML, CSS, and JSON editors. When you're in VS for Mac, you're using the same ones that you use for VS for Windows. We have the same backend debugger. We have the same Azure Publish infrastructure. And in the future, we're going to have the same JavaScript editor and Razor editor as well. And so the what I'm trying to do here is I want you to have the exact same experience, whether you're building .NET Core on Windows or Mac.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same. I don't care which OS you're on, but I'm going to have great support for both of those OSs. Other cool things, if you've been following our tech for a while, we have VS for Mac RTM comes with Publish to App Service. So you can publish your .NET Core applications to App Service. It's got the exact same Docker container support that we have in Visual Studio. So you can take an ASP.NET Core application, right-click, turn it into a container. You can run it in containers, debug it in containers. We have the same Publish to App Service containers in VS for Mac as we have in VS for Windows. And we have all the same Azure Functions tooling. So basically, any .NET Core thing you can do in VS, you can now do in for VS for Mac as well. And you can round trip. So you could have one developer on VS for Windows and one developer on VS for Mac.
Oh, wow. That says a lot. Yeah.
So that's a big one that I think's pretty cool as well. What else do I have that we haven't talked about yet?
lots of goodies. Yeah. The only thing that's tough for me now is like picking what IDE I want to be in, because I like VS Code, But if I'm doing .NET Core stuff, you know, now you have a whole bunch of great stuff in Visual Studio and it installs, you know, much quicker than it did in the past. You know, so I actually have it, you know, reinstalled on my machine. It's like, you know, you guys pulled me back into that environment. So now I just have, I have too many good options now.
That is my goal, sir, is that is to offer developers so many good options that they don't know what to do. It's like, ah. But that really is, that is kind of the future. You're going to see us continue to invest more and more in making sure that, hey, Windows, Mac, or command line on Windows or Mac or Linux, we have a great experience. The only area that we haven't completely nailed yet, in my opinion, is I think with the VS for Mac, the Macintosh gets into pretty good states. There's still a couple of experiences we don't have in the command line that we want to make there. Like I was mentioning, we have this great Docker support and container support in VS for Mac and VS for Windows. From command line, I don't yet have it where you can say .NET new web -- Docker. Gotcha. But that is coming. And so that'll be the final piece is for us to add the right command line tools. So you get the same experience in command line. You can actually get that experience to work. You just have to go hand edit some files today. So I have to go drop the Docker file and some Docker compose files in myself. Once I do that, you know, I can easily do demos that do it. But I want to make it as simple as .NET space new space web space -- Docker. And then you just say, you know, Docker run, and you're good to go. So,
okay. What about, this is kind of a weird question, but the, you know, the bash prompt in Windows, are you guys doing anything interesting with that? I mean, I think everything works in there, right? I don't know if there's anything special you guys are doing though.
We're not doing anything special there, at this point in time. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be surprised to see us do something special there in the future. I mean, the real question is going to be the bash prompt for Windows today, is primarily designed to be a developer experience.
Yeah.
I would love to see it be a runtime experience as well. You know, I'm speaking for the Windows team now. I'm not speaking for the Windows team, but I would love them to say that can be used for more than just development.
Yep.
And I'll kind of explain why I think it's interesting. Is, you know, even in the .NET world, some of the demos that we have and some of the things that I throw together with the containers, I'm very likely to have an ASP.NET Core application that uses two .NET microservices and maybe a Node microservice. I like to say in the world we're in today, it's very likely where I call it a heterogeneous environment. You're going to have a bunch of different runtimes running.
Yep.
If you go find a microservice that minimizes images and you find that there's a Node one, just use that. Go use the building blocks that exist. Don't feel like you have to go write everything in the technology that you spend most of your time in. Mm-hmm. And so I think if the bash shell actually had the ability to run apps in production, you know, for .NET Core, you're in good shape because .NET Core runs great on Windows. It runs great on Linux. It runs great on Mac. Things like Node actually runs great on Linux. Doesn't run so as well on Windows. And it's not because they try not to run great on Windows. It's because a lot of the packages out there in the NPM gallery, some of them take native dependencies.
Yeah.
And that those native dependencies are typically Unix based dependencies.
Yeah. I've seen them go the other way too, but yeah, they're usually.
I was going to say it leans more towards that than towards the Windows way. But if the bash shell had the ability to let you run in production, then it would be a better place to run Node on production on Windows than running Node on Windows on Windows. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. So.
Yeah, so I was also looking at the .NET Core roadmap. I mean, we discussed what's coming up in 2.0 about getting all the APIs from .NET Standard, the tooling, the performance, the cloud integrations. Are you talking at all yet or discussing what comes after 2.0?
We are, of course. So I have three big buckets of stuff that we're thinking about post the June timeframe. And one of the big buckets is what I would call performance and size improvements. So one of the things that is dear to my heart is I want to make the ability to change your source code, refresh your browser as fast as possible. Today, in VS, we're about 6 or 7 seconds there. I really, really want to get that below 2 seconds. So that's an area that we're going to focus on for I'm going to call this the November timeframe because we're going to do about three releases a year typically. I also want to make you know, I mentioned we brought all those APIs back. So .NET Core gets a little bit bigger. I'd love to have the ability for you to build a small, what I call standalone application. So I just want to go build the smallest ASP.NET Core application and put it into a container. And so I need to give you the tools to link out the parts of .NET Core that you're not using. So mm-hmm. we'll give you some linker capabilities there. And then I think the other one is I really want to give you the ability to make native .NET Core apps. And so Golang is probably the best language today for building cross-platform native apps. Because you write your app in Go, and it can basically emit exes for you that run on, you know, all the three platforms. And so I want to make .NET Core great for that. So that's kind of the performance and size stuff. When it comes to platforms is another interesting thing. So, you know, one of the things we've been talking about in the .NET space is the Tizen guys. Samsung's Tizen platform has taken a bet on .NET Core. That's what you actually use to build Tizen apps for their watches and their refrigerators and their televisions. We you know, showed some stuff at Build around that. But, you know, that's a platform. But I also care about IoT and ARM32. Mm-hmm. So I can't wait to be able to go and tell people if you want to go build, you know, ASP.NET Core apps running on Raspberry Pis or .NET Console apps that run on a Raspberry Pi, that's something that we treat as a first-class citizen. As I said, Tizen's doing it today. But you know, outside of Tizen, it's a experiment at this point. It's not something we've all supported. So that's an area we want to focus in. And then finally, the other one is around tools and libraries. One of the biggest questions that people always ask me is, what is our story about cross-platform UI? And so at Build, we actually, in Miguel's talk, we talked about something called XAML standard, which is having some XAML that's actually standardized across all the platforms.
Oh, that's cool.
And so what XAML standard means technically is if you build a Xamarin Forms application, you could then take that Xamarin Forms application and use that and make that into a UWP application, because UWP is basically XAML standard is the base XAML markup that's consistent across both UWP and Xamarin Forms.
Okay.
And so you could take a Xamarin Forms app and just turn it into a UWP application and then add Windows capabilities to it if you wanted to. Outside of that, the goal is to have XAML standard be able to run on other platforms. So you could build a Xamarin Forms application that runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux. So cross-platform cool. UI is very important to us. Another one is, you know, if you use Node, it's very common in the Node world to actually install via the Node Package Manager tools that we would call global tools. So if you've used Gulp or Grunt mm-hmm. or Bower, what you do is in Node, you say, you know, npm install -g. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you a -g for .NET as well. So if you want to go build a command line tool in .NET, you'll be able to basically, you know, .NET install -g name of package and get global tools. So that's a couple of the things that we're focusing on.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, you could have just stopped at the feature where we're the debugging feature, and that would have been enough. But man, lots of great stuff coming down.
As I always like to say, it's a great time to be a .NET developer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of thinking, like, you, when you guys really started, like, I'm gonna be kind of grotesque on it, but you guys started, like, ripping apart .NET, and then you know, you had to sort of reintegrate all these pieces. Like, that had to be so stressful, especially at the beginning. And now you have to, now that you're kind of like, I think you're over the hump, and you have to be at this point now where you're just like, okay, thank goodness this paid off. And like, everything's starting to make sense. The stars are aligning, and now you're able to add all this goodness. I mean, everything's really coming together. I think people now, you know, especially right after Build here they're really going to see the vision, and they're gonna say, man, this is where I want to be.
Yeah. We as a team, we're starting to have fun is what I like to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Less stress, more fun.
I got to run, guys.
Okay.
Hey,
that sounds good.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you guys very much.